Today is April the 14th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, that's the Progressive Radio Network, prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Parents struggling during the pandemic now have to deal with ransomware attacks on their kids' schools. The hackers infected Buffalo schools with malicious code that spied through their networks, freezing computers and making it impossible for teachers to reach their students who were working remotely because of the pandemic. They demanded a ransom to make it go away. School officials canceled remote classes for the day while they figured out what to do. They would end up needing more than a week to resume their planned class schedule. A single infection of a school district can affect dozens or hundreds of schools. Buffalo counts 63 individual schools and learning systems. In public statements, Buffalo Public Schools referred to what happened broadly as a cybersecurity attack. But it wasn't a mindless attack of internet vandalism. Buffalo had become the latest in a long spree of ransomware attacks, a type of hackware malicious software locks as many related computers as possible, rendering their files inaccessible in an attempt to coerce victims to pay up. The attackers underscore a once obscure form of cybercrime now preys on Americans almost daily. While some ransomware gangs spend months targeting large businesses in hopes of a giant payday, many also go after institutions that don't have dedicated cybersecurity staff or expensive cybersecurity contracts to better protect them from hackers, like hospitals and the city and county governments, which are often wide open to attack. Schools are soft targets, too. And during a pandemic, particularly soft ones, cyber criminals have recently ramped up attacks against American public school districts, with at least 44 of them this school year alone, according to account at the cybersecurity company Recorded Future. The FBI issued a warning in mid-March that ransomware attacks against schools were spiking, but the United States federal government has limited power to stop ransomware attacks. As recently as Thursday, schools in Haverhill, Massachusetts had to close. Cybersecurity company has estimated that ransomware attacks cost the United States more than $1.3 billion last year. The FBI often is the primary agency responding to ransomware attacks in the United States, but the agency focuses more on arrests than on disruption, and most ransomware gangs operate in countries where it's hard or impossible to get cyber criminals extradited. It's rare for the criminals to face serious repercussions. A spokesperson for Buffalo Schools declined to comment, citing an ongoing FBI investigation, and the agency also declined to comment. But school officials were clearly caught off guard by the severity of the hack, as they spent the next week issuing last-minute class cancellations. After calling off all remote classes for the day that first Friday, they announced Sunday evening that there would be no class whatsoever on Monday. Then Monday evening, they canceled in-person learning through Wednesday. Then Wednesday evening extended that ban for the rest of the week. The FBI and the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, the federal agencies that respond to ransomware victims, officially don't recommend paying a ransom to the hackers, both because doing so can encourage them to target more victims, and there's no guarantee that the hackers will honor the agreement. Paying isn't illegal in most cases, but it's still a risky prospect. A recent survey by the cybersecurity firm Kaspersky found that just over half of ransomware victims chose to pay, but 17% of those who did still never recovered their files. But sometimes the school would try to pay, only to find it impossible to negotiate with the hackers. In March, after negotiations broke down between one gang and Broward County, Florida's school system, one of the largest school districts in the country, with more than 260,000 students, the hackers published a transcript of their conversation on their website. The conversations show the gang initially asked for $40 million in ransom to the school officials' bafflement. Excerpt of conversation between a Broward County public schools official and a member of the criminal ransom gang posted to the gang's blog. A Broward spokesperson for the school declined to comment on the published negotiations but said in a statement, "We have no intention of paying a ransom." Even when the school catches the attack early and chooses not to pay the hackers, the cost can be severe, as was the case when the Afton, Missouri school district was hit in February. The district's director of technology received an early morning text message from a teacher that showed a picture of a computer with a picture of a ransom note. "Hi, company. Every byte on any type of your devices was encrypted," the hacker wrote. "Don't try to use backups because it was encrypted too." Excerpt of a conversation between a Broward County public schools official and a member of a criminal ransomware gang was posted to the gang's blog. Recognizing the potential for ransomware to spread quickly from computer to computer, the schoolmaster quickly ordered them all shut down and began examining computers individually to see which ones were infected. Only 30 were, and the school was able to replace them and resume classes the next day. But the hackers weren't done. As retaliation, they published the files they were able to exfiltrate from the infected computers, which included scores of tax and human resource documents like notes on teachers and their pay and the school's tax documents since 2018. Most of the damage is done by a dozen or so hackers groups, which effectively run as organized crime rings. Their members' identities are largely known to the FBI and U.S. Secret Service. Officials at those agencies say, but they tend to live in Russia or other Eastern European countries that don't extradite their citizens to the United States. The White House has a plan to deal with ransomware hackers, but such a plan is still several weeks away, said a top White House cybersecurity advisor. Ransomware is a matter of national security because it affects so many Americans, including our small businesses and state and local governments. Making progress to address ransomware will require cooperation with international partners. In some cases, hackers make remote learning nearly impossible. Huntsville City Schools in Alabama, which allows parents to choose whether their kids go to in-person class or learn remotely through the Huntsville Virtual Academy, sent everyone home on Monday, November the 30th, the first day back after Thanksgiving break, because of a ransomware attack. It took a week for in-person classes to resume, but because of lingering issues with school devices, the Huntsville Virtual Academy students for weeks learned purely through paper packets, with no interactions with their teachers. Every Sunday, parents drop off their students' previous week of paperwork and pick up new week's worth. The ransomware attackers are enabled because they demand the ransomware to be paid in Bitcoin, of which you can't trace who it is. And if you can, you can't extradite them from a foreign country. IBM spinoff NewCo now has a new name. It's Kyndryl. IBM said on Monday its managed infrastructure services business will be called Kyndryl after a planned spinoff into a public company later this year. The plan to separate was announced in 2020 and followed years of Big Blue trimming its legacy businesses as it focused on its cloud offerings to counter slowing software sales and seasonal demand for its mainframe servers. IBM Software and Solutions portfolio will account for the majority of the company's revenue after the separation. IBM said Kyndryl will be headquartered in New York City. The name Kyndryl may sound like a new pharmaceutical drug, but it's not. Kyndryl is a new name for IBM's legacy IT infrastructure business, which the company is spinning off into a new company to allow the main company to focus on its newer businesses. Kyndryl is the actual name of the IT services unit that IBM is spinning off from its core business. Soon, the 90,000 employees affected by the change will no longer say they work for IBM, which is perhaps one of the more classic, unambiguous corporate names ever. But instead for Kyndryl, whose meaning and pronunciation aren't immediately clear. IBM said the KYN part of the name is derived from the word kinship, and DRYL comes from tendril, which it said should bring to mind new growth and the idea that the business is always working towards advancing human progress. Somehow, explaining it just makes it worse. We can deduce that the pronunciation based on IBM's stated logic is Kyndryl, but the seemingly pronunciation based on IBM's stated logic is Kyndryl. Well, the seemingly arbitrary use of the Y's as a vowel opens the door to Long I's interpretation, Kyndryl. It's not easy to come up with new names. Many good names are already taken and protected by law. So the name chosen has no vowels, and initially no one is sure how it's pronounced. Over time, the name that may sound strange may be accepted and embraced. Corporate America has a history of questionable branding decisions which have left customers scratching their heads. In the end, the success or failure of a corporate name depends greatly on the success or failure of the company itself. It's the product that ultimately decides the success of the brand. The name is, well, just decoration. IBM creates a COBOL compiler for Linux on an x86 processor. News of the offering appeared in an announcement that states IBM COBOL for Linux on x86 1.1 brings IBM's COBOL compilation technologies and capabilities to the Linux on x86 environment. The latest addition to the IBM COBOL compiler family, which includes Enterprise COBOL for System Z operating system and COBOL for AIX. So why is IBM bothering to offer a COBOL compiler for Linux on x86? Well, because IBM thinks you may want your COBOL app in a hybrid cloud. COBOL shops have been promised that minimal customization effort is required to strategically deploy COBOL with CICS application developed for System Z operating system to run on Linux on the x86 and cloud environments. The new offering does that by linking to DB2 and IBM's customer information control system that many of us has referred to as CICS, so that apps on Linux using x86 can chat with older COBOL apps. Big Blue has also created a conversion utility that can migrate COBOL source code developed with non-IBM COBOL compilers. This solution also provides organization with the flexibility to move workloads back to the IBM Z should performance and throughput requirements increase, or to share business logic and data with CICS transaction server for the Z operating system. The new offering requires the Red Hat version 7.8 or later, or Ubuntu server 16.04 LTS or 18.04 LTS or later. Criminals spread malware using website contact forms with Google URLs. Crooks are using social engineering to exploit workers' efforts to do their jobs. Microsoft is warning businesses to beware of cyber criminals using company website contact forms to deliver the iced ID info-stealing banking Trojan in email with Google's URLs to employees. Company website contact us forms are an open doorway on the internet, and criminals have recently started using them to reach workers who receive contact requests from the public. A notable feature of the attack is that the crooks are using the contact forms to send employees legitimate Google URLs that require users to sign in with their Google username and password. Microsoft considered the threat serious enough to report the attacks to Google's security teams to warn them that cyber criminals are using legitimate Google URLs to deliver malware. The Google URLs are useful to the attackers because they will bypass email security filters. The attackers appear to have also bypassed CAPTCHA, that's CAPTCHA, challenges that are used to test whether the contact submission is from a human. Attackers are abusing legitimate infrastructure, such as websites' contact forms, to bypass protections, making this threat highly evasive. In addition, attackers use legitimate URLs. In this case, Google's URLs that require targets to sign in with their Google credentials. The Microsoft 365 Defender Threat Intelligence team noted this. Microsoft is concerned by the technique used and has currently detected the criminals using the URLs in email to deliver iced ID malware, but it could just as easily be used to transmit other malware. Iced ID is a banking Trojan and information stealer and can be used as an entry point for subsequent attacks, such as manually operated ransomware for high-value targets. Human-operated ransomware attacks are increasingly common and require the attacker to sit at the keyboard and orchestrate the attack, in contrast to an automated attack. Microsoft said that they have already alerted security groups at Google to bring attention to this threat as it takes advantage of Google URLs. Google said that they have observed an influx of contact form emails targeted at enterprises by means of abusing companies' contact forms. This indicates that attackers may have used a tool that automates this process while circumventing CAPTCHA protections, the companies added. This is a tricky attack for companies and government agencies to detect, since the email arrives to employees from their own contact form and email marketing systems. As the emails are originating from the recipient's own contact form on their website, the email templates match what they would expect from an actual customer interaction or inquiry. The attackers use language that applies pressure on the employee to respond false claims that the targeted website is using copyrighted images, for example. The email contains a link to the site's google.com page where the employee is meant to view the supposedly infringing images. If the employee does their job and investigates a claim by signing into the site, the sites.google.com page automatically downloads a zip file with a JavaScript file, which in turn downloads the iced ID malware as a .dat file, that's a .dat file, and it also downloads a component of the penetration testing kit, Cobalt Strike, that allows the attacker to control the device over the internet. Translation: I would be very wary and leery of using contact forms. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to Office, Part 1 of 6.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I spend some time talking to you about the work world and how that is going to, in this case, how that's going to change. We are starting on a 6-part series that is the post-COVID outlook on work. And worldwide, let's go back. Worldwide, a little bit more than a year ago, we shifted in a matter of about 3 weeks. We shifted from 9% of the people working at home to 95%. We all had to adapt. We had to determine what could be done from home and what could not. As we near, right now, the potential for the return to normal. And look, I'm not a soothsayer. I'm not going to say that this is definitely going to be what happens. But I do want to hit on a few aspects to consider. We're right now passing just a little bit more than 20-some-odd percent of the people have been vaccinated fully. Now, there are business decisions that are going to be made. These are decisions that you may be involved in, you may not be involved in, but you do need to be aware of them. Of course, we all know that there's going to be the easy one, masks or no masks. And, you know, that's when do you wear the masks? When do you not have to wear the masks? And we have a lot of different people who have their own views on their personal political approach to whether masks are necessary or not. But when you're in the office, the bosses make the decisions. So there are going to be issues in regards to special cleaning procedures. The amount of cleaners that we had in the office before all of this started is going to double or triple. Yes, you're going to have a lot different of an approach to cleaning the office. The few companies where people are still in the office, that's what they've experienced, a marked increase in cleaners. We're also going to be dealing with, okay, all of the different people who have moved into just a completely different direction in their life where they've become germaphobes. And I don't want that term to mean anything negative. It's just a matter of where we've been so concerned that we are wiping down more things than we used to. We're being cleaner than we used to. And that's okay. That's perfectly fine. But how does the company control that? How does the company supply for that? Because if you're using a lot more tissues, if you're using a lot more cleaning supplies for the office than you used to, the company has to account for that. There is going to be a new level of redesign for office spaces, and they are going to have to add infrastructure and more to meet the in-person needs. All right, so what are we talking about? All right, let's put aside any of the people side of this. Let's talk about the technical side of this. We're going to be talking about changing the cube farm designs. These minimum height walls in a cube farm, well, they're not conducive to preventing the spread of the disease. So we're going to see a lot of cube farms where all of a sudden you're gaining more privacy. We're going to go through logistics of things like the phased returns, where we bring in 20% of the employees and we try that out for a month or two. And then we bring in another 20% and we keep working along those lines. But some of the different aspects are going to also change because we may see a hoteling operation. What is hoteling? Hoteling is where you come in and you bring in your laptop, you hook up to at a desk for the full day. You're at the desk for a full day operating as if that is your assigned desk. But at the end of the day, you pack up what things that you have that stay in the office into a box, a suitcase, if you will, and you turn in that suitcase. And it's stored somewhere. Well, so someone has to store that, and there's the cleaning requirements for the storage. So there's a lot of stuff like that. We also have issues of split shifts by weeks. We've heard of things like that. They're going to be less flexible on the days when you can come in. Also, they're going to say, well, if you're coming in for 2 hours, just stay home. We're also going to see the idea of paid time off for sickness is going to shift dramatically. Sniffle and stay home. This is the term I like, but there are many others. If you are sniffling, working from home is still better than we're going to get, 100% productivity out of you versus sending you home every time you have a sniffle. Oh, what? We're in spring allergy season. So there is going to have to be an expanded infrastructure to allow for those people who are marginally ill. I mean, we are going to be looking at no more conference rooms for major meetings. As a matter of fact, 1 in 3 people feel comfortable traveling for business. 19% internationally. 28% would go to an office party. So we're going to be seeing a lot more video conferencing. We're going to be seeing a lot more technical infrastructure that's going to be required, that's going to be needed. Communications are going to be most important throughout all of this. From the employer and the employee. None of this can be done lightly. I want you to approach from your best perspective, knowing that rash decisions are the worst. In the coming weeks, we're going to be covering stay home and you want to, go back and you want to. But on the other side, go back and you don't want to, stay home and you don't want to. And then the hybrid model. We'll be covering all of that in the coming weeks here in this IT Pro series. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. AT&T is lobbying against proposals to subsidize fiber to the home deployment across the United States, arguing that rural people don't need fiber and should be satisfied with internet service that provides only 10 megabits per second upload speeds. AT&T detailed in a blog post titled "Defining Broadband for the 21st Century," AT&T's preferred definition of the 21st century broadband could be met with wireless technology or AT&T's VDSL, which is a 14-year-old system that brings fiber to neighborhoods but uses copper telephone wires for the final connection into each home. This VDSL connection offers 24 megabits per second downstream peak rates and 3 megabits per second upstream rates. AT&T stated there would be significant additional cost to deploy fiber to virtually every home and small business in the country, when at present there is no compelling evidence that those expenditures are justified over the service quality of a 50/10 or a 100/20 megabits per second product. AT&T wrote that would be 50 megabits per second download speeds with 10 megabits upload speeds, or 100 megabits download with 20 megabits upload. AT&T said that overbuilding areas that already have acceptable speeds would needlessly devalue private investments and waste broadband-directed dollars. Overbuilding is what the broadband industry calls one ISP building in an area already served by another ISP, whereas internet users desperate for cheaper, faster, and more reliable service call that broadband competition. There is a proposed $80 billion fund in Congress to deploy broadband with download and upload speeds of 100 megabits per second to serve unserved areas. The administration is also planning a $3 trillion package that includes funding for rural broadband, among many other priorities. The United States subsidizing deployment of symmetrical 100 megabits per second speeds would help other ISPs bring fast broadband to areas where AT&T still use old phone lines that have fallen into disrepair because AT&T hasn't properly maintained them. AT&T could bid for the funding too, of course, but it doesn't want to build fiber throughout rural areas. AT&T previously said it is deploying fiber to 3 million more homes and businesses this year, but the company is only doing so in metro areas and mostly in those metro areas where AT&T already built out most of the infrastructure and can get a better return on investment. AT&T has been fighting against increases in broadband speed benchmarks for years. Back in 2014, AT&T urged the Federal Communications Commission to keep the standard of 4 megabits per second download and 1 megabits per second upload. AT&T claimed at that time that even 10 megabits per second download would exceed what many Americans need today. But the FCC raised the standard to 25 megabits per second down and 3 megabits per second up in January of 2015. AT&T's current fixed wireless service only provides download speeds of 10 to 25 megabits per second and upload speeds of only 1 megabits per second. But the company plans upgrades that could help the wireless service qualify for the proposed $80 billion fund if Congress doesn't require high upload speeds. AT&T did take $428 million per year from the FCC starting back in 2015 to bring 10 megabits per second download and 1 megabits per second upload speeds to 1.1 million rural homes and businesses in 18 states. However, AT&T gave FCC false broadband coverage data and Mississippi officials accused the telco of failing to deploy the required broadband. AT&T said it was correcting the mistakes and that it would meet the end of 2020 deployment deadline in all 18 states. A 100 megabits per second upload requirement could also prod cable companies into finally deploying the symmetrical cable services. Comcast and other companies still limit upload speeds to 35 megabits per second on gigabyte download plans. AT&T addressed two topics: how broadband should be defined to determine which homes are considered unserved, and what types of broadband networks should be chosen when the government distributes funding to the ISPs. AT&T argued that the FCC's six-year-old broadband definition of 25 megabits per second downstream and 3 megabits per second upstream is sufficient to support Zoom working and remote learning. But AT&T admitted when Zooming, streaming, and tweeting is combined in an average household of four, it's easy to conclude that download speeds must be increased. AT&T is opposed to a broadband definition that requires symmetrical upload and download speeds. A definition built on symmetrical speeds could dramatically expand the locations deemed unserved, leading to some areas being unnecessarily overbuilt while leaving fewer dollars to support areas in greater need, which tend to be rural. AT&T wrote the following, that they admitted that fiber technology is the most future-proof, but said that bringing fiber to every home is not practical. Some flexibility must be preserved, they said, particularly for the next generation of fixed wireless technologies likely to be deployed in the recently auctioned C-band that will easily deliver performance at 100 megabits per second down. But wireless networks are not built to deliver symmetrical speeds, so any mandate around symmetrical performance could undermine delivery of these efficient and robust technology solutions in hard-to-serve areas of the country. AT&T also argued that the monthly bills for fiber service will be too expensive for many rural customers. As higher-speed networks get deployed to rural America, the current availability challenge could easily become an affordability one, AT&T said. But the point of an $80 billion fund to deploy high-speed broadband is to subsidize deployment so that rural customers get the same service at similar prices as urban customers. A bill summary provided by the House said that ISPs accepting subsidies would have to provide at least 100 and 100 megabits per second with sufficiently low latency, offering broadband service at prices that are comparable to or lower than the prices charged for comparable service, and offering an affordable service plan. Congress already approved of $7.17 billion in funds that schools and libraries will use to help people get internet access at home. Separately, the pending legislation proposed would add $6 billion to the Emergency Broadband Connectivity Fund for Americans who have low incomes who lost their jobs during the pandemic. Congress initially provided $3.2 billion for that fund. The comparison between fiber and electricity has been made by numerous broadband advocates over the year. The only household that should be exempted from a fiber requirement are those that lack a connection to the electrical grid. If you run power to a house, you can run fiber to a house. So, let's think this over. How much money is on the table? Well, the proposed $80 billion fund that Congress wants to deploy for broadband and approve $7.17 billion fund that schools and libraries have already gotten, and add to that $6 billion to the Emergency Broadband Connectivity Fund for Americans. That totals $93.17 billion. By the way, this is all federal funding, not money from any corporation. What money are they putting up? And just remember, when this is all done, the income revenue benefits the company. To recap, what AT&T is saying is that rural people don't need fiber and should be satisfied with internet service that provides only 10 megabits upload speeds. And they're also saying that the FCC's six-year-old broadband definition of 25 megabits per second downstream and 3 megabits per second upstream is sufficient for the country, for everyone. What is the real digital divide? The issue of digital divide in the United States is real, but the focus has been mainly to allocate funds to subsidize internet access instead of looking at the root causes. According to the Wikipedia, the digital divide refers to the gap between those able to benefit from the digital age and those who are not. The concern is that people without access to the internet and other information and communication technologies will be disadvantaged, as they are unable or less able to obtain digital information, shop online, participate democratically, or learn skills and office skills. This resulted in programs to give computers and related services to people without access. Well, the Wikipedia has it mostly right, except they omitted a very important factor. One of the root causes for digital divide has to do with the internet coverage. If there is no coverage, allocating money to subsidize those who do not have internet service, it won't help. If the coverage is there, but the bandwidth is not there, that also will not resolve the issue. If the bandwidth is at the federal level defined by the FCC, which is 25 down and 10 up, that's not going to really help at all. Guess who verifies the speed provided by internet service providers? The multiple federal agencies, and that means a number of federal agencies that are responsible for regulating the internet, have assigned that to the internet service providers. They are only required to be able to achieve up to speeds and not required to provide consistent speed. The assumption made by many studies is that if you have the internet, you have a computer. Many, however, just use a smartphone for their internet usage, and this falls short when you need to work from home. There is a shortage of computers, and why Chromebooks are in short supply for school kids, because they either don't have a computer, or there is only one computer in the house to be shared by all members of family during this pandemic crisis. A major part of the country affected by the digital divide is in the rural areas of the country. The carriers are only required to provide a single subscriber connection coverage within a defined census block. In most cases, that's a zip code. The internet service provider can then claim coverage for the whole area, even if the rest of the census block has no connection. A recent study by Microsoft has provided the most accurate of information as to who does not have adequate internet service. By the way, their count is 163 million Americans. With a lockdown in which families have had to be online for schooling and work, the Microsoft study seems to be most on target as to how large is the digital divide. First of all, there's no competition out there, or if there is, there are only a few limited number of internet service providers franchised by the local governments. The local governments have franchised who can provide internet services. We are also allowing the service providers to report on internet up and down stream speeds. We accept the ISP definition of coverage as to a cable passing by census block, but not necessarily connecting to any subscriber. We have regulating agencies auctioning off parts of the frequency spectrum. By the way, the latest auction brought in $45 billion. You think that money went to internet infrastructure? No, it just went straight into the Treasury. The Pew Research just a couple weeks ago reported that 7% of Americans don't use the internet. Who are they? Today, 25% of adults ages 65 and older report never going online, compared with much smaller shares of adults under the age of 65. To overcome digital divide, what needs to happen? The digital divide as a whole remains an enormous and complicated issue, heavily interwoven with the issues of race, education, and poverty. The COVID-19 crisis has highlighted a more accurate extent of the digital divide in the United States. The pandemic shutdown has forced people to alter the way they live and work. Millions of employees and students have had to carry out everything from staff meetings to math classes online every day, and in an effort to ease hospital overcrowding and keep patients out of cramped waiting rooms, the government is urging patients to seek consultation through phone calls and video conferencing. But not everyone in the United States has access to these online services. there are more than 14 million people without any internet access and 25 million more without the faster and more reliable broadband access. And this is according to the 2018 Federal Communications Commission study. The reported figures are an undercount, however. The FCC data is based on census blocks and not households. The data may show that broadband provider serves a particular service block, but not every household in that block may access that service. Microsoft has said its research shows that if broadband access was counted more precisely, the number of Americans without it would be closer to 163 million people. Who doesn't have access? The United States ranks 10th among 28 countries in broadband download speeds in 2016. The U.S. ranking is actually overgenerous. The FCC data is based on speeds that internet service providers advertise, not what is actually in place. U.S. consumers consistently pay much more for access for broadband than users in other countries. Internet is so expensive in the United States because of a lack of competition. In some other countries, there are a large number of local or semi-local ISPs that fill in the gaps where national ISPs don't have coverage or have competed with the national ISP market. That, however, is not the case in the United States. The lack of reliable and affordable internet access is especially severe in rural communities, where only 2 out of every 3 people say they have broadband access, according to a Pew Research Center survey conducted in early 2019. The survey shows that people in rural communities are less likely to have a home computer, smartphone, or other devices that provides access to the internet. School-age students are also affected. One study of students in 2018 found that low-income students, first-generation college students, and students of color were more likely to have access only to a single device, such as a home computer, tablet, or smartphone. For many, that device was only a smartphone. Poorer neighborhoods with high poverty rates were found to have slower download speeds because AT&T didn't provide those areas with up-to-date broadband improvements. An AT&T spokesperson said that the company doesn't make its infrastructure decisions based on household income or race. But even without the current public health crisis highlighting this problem, access to broadband and home computers have been considered key to student success. A 2018 Pew Research Center analysis showed that poor school-age children are less likely to finish their homework than those who live in the more affluent areas because they lack broadband internet access. The problem is starker for low-income Black and Latino households. Having a computer can be the difference between finishing high school or not. Students with a computer home were more likely to graduate than those who didn't have one, according to a Western Economic Association international study. We don't have systems in place in the United States to make sure that everyone does have access to the internet. But some say achieving widespread broadband access will require aggressive government intervention. The internet must be regulated as a utility like electricity. A utility is not a luxury. Utility services can be sold by private or public entities, but they are always subject to public obligations to reach everyone at a reasonable price, with a service meeting public quality standards. As technology extends its reach into all corners and culture, and black box algorithms shape our lives in untold ways, we need to change our perspective as to what are real causes in the digital divide. We have been so conditioned to view every issue as related to racial, diversity, and equality agendas. It seems no one is really looking at the real problem. The pandemic resulting in students and workers to work at home has proven that we really don't have an accurate assessment of the problem. Throwing money at the problem when the infrastructure is splintered won't solve the problem. Instead of negotiating with the ISPs, we should state the objectives. If they say they can't meet it, we should find someone else to do the job. Just think. Just in the past year, $93.17 billion of federal funding is going to be assigned to internet infrastructure. That is not chump change. We should receive value for what we spend. Presenting Marty Winston with All Hands on Tech, Surface Changes. We'll be right back.
If most of your computer experience involves traditional PCs with their motherboards and system unit cases, you know, their keyboards and mice and monitors as outboard peripherals, if that's you, if that's your experience, then the current age of personal computers might be, well, distressing to you. Your notebook PC probably doesn't have an extended keyboard with separate number pad and cursor control areas, let alone full travel keys with detents and clicks, and you may not like needing to reach over a touchpad to get at your keyboard. You may not like that touchpad being your only point-and-click device. You're used to mice, doggone it, or like me, you're a trackball addict. And those screens, how can anybody possibly get any work done on a screen that's only 13 or 15 inches? Not to mention the fly-spec fonts when those small screens show off their 4K resolution. Whose idea was that? And now that you're in the mood for grousing, how can half or a quarter of a terabyte possibly be enough to store everything? How much will it hurt performance to be limited to just 16 gigabytes of RAM? How are you supposed to get by on just one or two USB ports? Well, there are answers to all of this, and they're not as onerous as you may fear. But listen, everybody, if you're already into the current age of computing with something like a Microsoft Surface 3 or something similar from Lenovo or Dell or one of the others, you too have a reason to listen. Changes like this are part of the DNA of personal computing, and your day will come when another set of changes suddenly yanks you away from what's familiar and into some strange new experience that every fiber in your body tells you can't possibly work. The same boomers who grouse about this Microsoft Surface generation have been through this change thing more than a few times. The Pioneer generation, you know, Hank Key's group, they may miss their punched paper tape or punched card programming days or those giant tape drives. A generation younger than that, and they're wondering why their computers don't have floppy disk drives or outboard modems anymore. A generation younger than that may miss their compact disk or DVD drives. It's always something. But let's get to those answers. The biggest reason older computers needed a lot of RAM was to make up the speed difference between speedy microprocessors and relatively slow hard drives that used spinning magnetic platters for storage. Today's solid-state drives are so fast that there's really nothing to gain by buffering them in RAM. It's unexpected and amazing, but even an intensive multitasker won't see a slowdown with just 16 gigabytes of RAM. And the reason those solid-state drives don't need to have a multiple terabyte capacity is that there's a lot less for them to hold. Between OneDrive, Google Drive, and Dropbox, secure online storage can fill that role and do it across multiple devices. Those files aren't trapped in a single machine anymore. Like storage, software is increasingly cloud-based. Microsoft Office 365 and Adobe Acrobat Pro DC are great examples of that, and far from the only ones. The work-at-home requirements that many faced during the pandemic, well, of course, that made the idea of a new full-size PC, shall we say, unattractive. Smaller computing platforms like the Surface 3 provided a less intrusive presence in often cramped personal spaces. Initially, while many were satisfied with the transition, some were, at least initially, resentful. That's been shifting. One interesting outcome is how many people have learned to take advantage, very adept advantage, of the little shortcuts that once were the selective province of power users. Of course, adapting has always been part of the personal computing experience, even here. Our Surface 3 has not yet been here very long. And for fast hunt-and-peck typing, the trackpad's position is at least an inconvenience. A lot of typos show up. As a pointer, trackpads have never been a favorite, but it's okay. Of course, the 15-inch touchscreen is an option. Happily, a new Kensington Pro Fit Ergo Vertical Wireless Trackball, connects over Bluetooth, feels familiar, is cool, and works extremely well. The desktop system here, the desktop, our traditional system, uses a pair of 43-inch 4K screens, and it's not unusual to have a dozen windows open at once. It's hard to get as many as half a dozen on the Surface's own screen, but if that gets to be a handicap, there's always the option of adding an external monitor later, which of course would make it considerably less portable. Still, in a two-desk circumstance, one at a home office and one at a business office, even where the Surface 3 stays in the bag when working at home, there's potentially a lot of flexibility in a more familiar second location Nest. Add a traditional keyboard and monitor and trackball or mouse, and you've just made that skinny sliver of a computer into a totable system unit. Pretty amazing. Except that when you're in any third location, traveling or visiting or killing time somewhere, the Surface 3 alone is all you need to get real work done. For us, Microsoft's 15-inch Surface Laptop 3 adds a nobility to mobility in a finely engineered PC. We like it. I like it. Next time, we hope to report on a new service in Cleveland that uses best-of-breed UVC robots to turn pathogens into goners. If that gets delayed, we'll turn our focus to indoor and outdoor air quality. And the days soon ahead when, if you're not careful, both can take a turn for the worst, plus the tech that can help you prevent that. You will be here, right?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Software for Landing Perseverance on Mars, Thursday, April the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, May 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. And the Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. That's limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.